This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon, I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we'll find out more about what the city of Hammond plans to do as ways to do some energy conservation projects going. We'll talk with a representative of the Chicago area firm that is working with the city on this big project. And we'll also talk with Michelle Billick from goodcall.com. The website's put out their annual best cities for first responders, and we have a couple communities on that list. And we'll also have a conversation with Andy Downs of the Mike Downs Center for Politics at IU Purdue Fort Wayne, getting caught up on some Hoosier politics, in particular with the visibility of a Governor Eric Holcomb. The city of Hammond is partnering with a company that's based in Hoffman Estates, Illinois, to come up with some ideas that will create an energy conservation program for the city that could, eventually over time, save the city of Hammond millions of dollars in its energy costs. And with us to talk about it, we have Rob Volrath, who is a business executive with Leopardo Energy, and about the company that is working with the city of Hammond on this project. Rob, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, tell us, if you will, first, what Leopardo Energy does and how the city of Hammond is interested in working with you folks.
Well, we specialize in energy savings performance contracting for the public sector, specifically cities and counties, where we go in and find ways to significantly reduce their utility and operating expenses to fund project improvements. The program utilizes guaranteed savings where we come through and identify opportunities to make those utility and operating cost reductions. And those savings that we come up with guarantee, we send a report to the state every year. So if we fail to deliver the savings that we forecasted in our proposals, we have to write a check to the city for the difference of what we guaranteed to save it versus what we delivered. And we've got a $1.6 million guarantee annually at the city of Hammond.
That's great. That's great. How did Mayor Tom McDermott Jr. Come across Leopardo Energy?
Well, we reached out to them. So we started with, we had meetings with their finance department. So we started out having meetings with them. They gave us the authorization to allow us to look at ways to reduce their utility operating costs, and then we came back to them with a report. And then at that point, they got the mayor involved when they were able to see some tangible evidence of what we could provide for them.
That's right. Now, when you take a look at projects like this, what have you done so far, and what is Leopardo Energy going to be doing in the next few months or so, at least over the next year or so, to determine where these energy conservation savings can come?
Well, we've already done that. We've already identified where the savings are going to come from. Now we're at the stage of actually we're in pre-construction right now, and then we'll be starting project execution very soon. But it'll come from we had identified 13 buildings for upgrades to their lighting systems, so interior and exterior lighting, as well as HVAC and building automation control upgrades, as well as city-owned streetlights and making improvements to the vehicles to run on alternative fuel to reduce the fuel costs and maintenance costs associated with the vehicles.
Now, any of these buildings that you folks have already looked at and are on the project are well-known buildings, or well-traveled buildings, so to speak, for the city of Hammond?
Yeah, it's the Civic Center, the fire stations, the police department, parks department, public works department. It's pretty much every building they own and maintain.
Wow.
In the city outside of City Hall. It's the only building that we're not doing at this point.
Okay. Does this energy conservation program extend out to, say, the street department, for example, when it's time to replace lamps along the city streets, the curbs and sidewalks, that maybe we'll be looking for different types of more energy-efficient lighting, like LED lighting or things like that?
Yeah, we're converting all the city-owned street lights to LED.
Oh, wow. Well, for people that aren't aware of the change that they'll see, that they haven't noticed already for some cities and towns here in Northwest Indiana that have already made the change, what will pedestrians and motorists see in the difference between the sodium vapor lights and the older lights and the new LED lights?
Well, we actually tested some lights. So there was back in, it was either January or February, we had put some LED lights up on one of the blocks in Hammond and let people see them, and the staff selected which type of fixture they wanted to use based on, I believe, feedback from not only the staff but from the community as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, since you've been working primarily with the city of Hammond on the project now, or any other opportunities that the citizens and local contractors that might be able to get involved in some of this energy conservation work, finally get a chance to meet with you folks and they can talk about it.
Yeah, we've already done that. We had a pre-bid meeting a couple weeks ago, mm-hmm. and local participation was included. There were multiple contractors there, so we will be utilizing local contractors for all of the trades.
That's great. That's great. What do they seem to say about some of the things that you're proposing?
Oh, they're excited. From my feedback, now I haven't had as much interaction with them as our project management team has. But all the feedback I've heard has been good, because these are the nice thing about this program is we're able to make needed capital improvements in the buildings as well as with the streetlights, make these improvements by utilizing savings that they're already budgeting for. So we're reducing the amount of money that they'll be spending today and reallocating those savings to pay for these improvements, so it doesn't impact the taxpayers at all. So it's a great program.
We're talking with Rob Volrath, who is with Leopardo Energy, which is based out of the Hoffman Estates, Illinois. It's a company that does a lot of energy conservation research and planning for communities like, in this case, the city of Hammond. They're engaging in a very, very extensive and very ambitious energy conservation program that's likely to save millions of dollars over at least the next decade, maybe longer, in what the city has to pay out for electricity and other utilities as well. What kind of timetable do you folks have now, since you're in the project stage now that you've got people, contractors interested in this? What's the changeover likely to happen?
Yeah, I mean, the anticipated time is, I believe, 10 months from now. Mm-hmm. Everything will be done now. I'm not the project manager on it, but it's 10, 12 months from now, the project will be completed.
Wow! That's going to be an opportunity for the public to actually see not only brighter street lights and more clear to see traffic ways, I guess, in the region, but also these people that work in the buildings in particular are going to see a chance to maybe have a little cooler, a little warmer in the winter months.
Totally.
It's going to be a big change for them, I would imagine.
Yeah, you'll notice the difference when you step into the buildings when this thing's all completed. Just the indoor air quality will be dramatically improved.
That's great. Now, besides working with the city of Hammond, has Leopardo Energy done any other projects here in Northwest Indiana that they might notice that people would say, oh, this is something of note? They've seen what's happened in these other locations, and here's what they can expect to see in Hammond.
We haven't done any other projects in Lake County, but we've done projects all across the state. Mm-hmm. We've done projects in Illinois, Ohio, all throughout the state of Indiana, Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
We're kind of a mess contractor.
So you're looking forward to be able to expand here in Northwest Indiana?
And oh, absolutely.
And you'll
absolutely.
Certainly, and you'll certainly
we're,
have...
We're talking. We're having preliminary conversations with other communities. None of them have gotten to the point where they're as far along as Hammond has.
Well, this is great. Well, that means that you've got how things are happening in the city of Hammond to show here's what's happening here, and that's certainly going to make me convince other communities here, not only in Northwest Indiana, but more in Indiana, to get you folks involved and do these planning projects.
That's what we're hoping.
That's the best you could hope for, I suppose, and certainly
right.
It's going to save us the energy cost to be sure that's coming up here. Once again, we're looking, I guess, from what's planned so far of energy conservation measures that could guarantee more than $26 million in energy savings over 15 years or so. That's a lot
correct.
Of money, and that's going to mean a lot for the taxpayers of the city of Hammond, to be sure.
Absolutely.
We're talking with Rob Volrath, who is with the business team at Leopardo Energy. It's a company that's based out of the suburban Chicago area that does a lot of work on energy conservation planning for communities, and in particular, this case, a big project for the city of Hammond. Rob, thank you very much for spending time to talk about the project, and we'll be checking back in here over the months ahead and hope to have you some great news to come out of that. Thank you very much. Two communities in Lake County have recently been ranked as prime areas in the United States for first responders to live and work. It's the third annual Best Cities for First Responders report that's come out by the consumer research website goodcall.com. And Michelle Billick is with us to talk about it. Michelle, thank you for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Well, tell us first, if you will, how did GoodCall.com come up with the data and how they've ranked it here so that the community of Highland ranked number 9 in the list for the best cities for first responders for this year, and Merrillville ranking number 12?
So to start, GoodCall is all about, our mission is to give knowledge, tools, tips to when you need to make good calls when it comes to key life components of every person's life. So securing an education, finding a career, finding the right home, saving for the future. And these, we develop a bunch of reports to help with life decisions, and this is one of them. So looking at the best first responders communities. With this particular one, we looked at 8 metrics, including data from Indeed, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, thebestplaces.net, FBI crime data. And we compiled all this information together to come up with the good call score of what would make up a best place for a first responder.
I understand, looking at the overall list here of the 2017 best cities for first responders, Midwest did pretty well. The first couple spots or so, at least the first within the first 10, several of them are in Michigan or in Illinois, as well as the ones in Highland, Indiana, at number 9, and Merrillville, Indiana, is number 12. Are these, from what you folks determined, some of the best spots that first responders can find a place to live and a good job as well, too, with so many ambulance services and other first responders around?
Yeah, it's really interesting when we compile these different data points to see what actually spits out as a result. And for this particular list, it appeared that there were a lot that were considered smaller cities to rank highly, which is always great to see, the recognition of these smaller towns and the efforts that they're putting towards making this career great in their communities. This particular list, a lot of the information was, or a lot of the results were spread among various parts of the country, so there wasn't quite as much of a huge presence in one area over another. Mm-hmm. But the Midwest did do quite well, as you mentioned before, that the Indiana cities that were ranked very highly.
It's interesting to see this as well, that the Midwest has done well. I know some sections of the country, for some reason, according to the data that came up in the report, didn't do so well. I guess sections of the Southeast and New England even and Western states other than California didn't seem to list prominently in some of the top cities here. Is it a lot of it because you talk about in the data of trying to find places that first responders can not only financially do well, but they can live well? That is, it doesn't cost them a lot to be able to rent a house, an apartment, or something like that. The groceries don't cost quite as much. You can go to a restaurant and find a nice meal, and it doesn't cost you a lot of money. And some of these other places, maybe the prices are a little too high.
Exactly. So that's one thing that we pride ourselves when we put together these reports. We want to find areas that are very well-rounded. So not just, you know, focusing on one metric, looking at, like, say, the salary, for example, or the amount of jobs in the area. It's important to be listing places that people could really see themselves in all the way around, looking at, like you mentioned, the amenities in the area. What can they do outside the time that they're spending at work? You know, is it affordable? What's the crime look like in that area? Mm-hmm. Making sure that we have a really, you know, well-rounded, supported data behind the information.
Is there anything that these communities can take out of this report that has come out here from GoodCall.com and take it back, certainly use it to do some crowing, pride in their own cities and all, but they can use to help improve the services?
Yeah, definitely. And it's a great chance to just, like, recognize the people that are putting forth, you know, in a position such as first responders. It's a very high-stress position, and it might not be one that people think of top of mind even when these types of reports come out. And it's important to highlight and to honor these people that sacrifice day in and day out for others in the community. So it's a great recognition. It's a great way for them to see, okay, you know, we were highlighted for this. How can we continue to improve our area for these positions and making sure that we're always keeping them in mind as far as recognition for the city?
We're talking with Michelle Billick, who is with the consumer research website, GoodCall.com. GoodCall.com has just put out their third annual Best Cities for First Responders list across the country, and we have two communities here in Lake County in Northwest Indiana that have ranked really well in that list, the town of Highland and the town of Maryville, Indiana. And we appreciate the information. If you'd like to find out more, you can go to GoodCall.com on the website and take a look at the report in the data center section of the 2017 Best Cities for First Responders. And Michelle, thank you very much for spending time to talk with us about how our communities here in Northwest Indiana are doing. And looking forward to see how well some of our area cities rank in the 2018 Best Cities list next time.
Thank you so much, Chris.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Back in November 2016, the city of Gary invested in the creation of a culinary food incubator called The Art House, a social kitchen. Lakeshore Public Radio's Stephen Lattimore reports that local businesses say the culinary incubator is helping them sustain and expand their businesses.
The Art House Food and Social Kitchen Culinary Business Incubator Project in Gary is now bearing the fruit from the investment made to get it off the ground by Bloomberg Philanthropies and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. At a recent showcase at the Art House, local food businesses got a chance to show off their best.
Chocolate chip and toffee is... it's pretty much the perfect mixture.
Sweet potato cheesecake and our Snickers cheesecake.
It's just moist, and it wants you to come back for more.
Arlene Peterson is with the Art House Social Kitchen. She says it's great to see the harvest from the seeds that they have planted.
I think that's the amazing piece for me, to see these folks who maybe been baking out of their home or doing their little product on the side, but now really are thinking as entrepreneurs, as business people, and like, how can I do something next? Like Keon, now he's got a kiosk. I guarantee you, kiosk, next thing in him, there's going to be a cupcake shop, you know, somewhere set up that he's going to be, you know, having cupcakes 24/7. They all are ready to kind of, again, take it to the next level from, you know, I've just been doing this on the side and I'm doing this, but let's start thinking as a business. Let's start thinking as an entrepreneur.
Frank and Kimonique Jones run California Jones Catering. They say the help that they have been given from the Art House Kitchen is invaluable.
But there's so much more room here, and just the equipment that is available is good.
One thing that I think that point that comes to mind is that we talked about, why do most food industry businesses fail, and especially restaurants, and it was mainly because of the food cost and the cost of labor. So what I had learned from there is that they helped me to make sure that my food cost is very low so that we can make a profit. And right now, since we are the only two that are in there, I don't have to worry that much about the labor cost. But when it does come about, I have to make sure that with my finances that I tailor that into our business, that we can continue to thrive and continue to grow as we do so.
Organizers hope that the Art House, a Social Kitchen in Gary, will develop a thriving restaurant district that will add revenue and jobs to Gary's economy. In Gary, Stephen Lattimore, Lakeshore Public Radio.
You might find yourself at a community event this summer, like a food festival, an art fair, or an outdoor concert. Some will serve as a company fundraiser, but others, like Open Bite Night near downtown Indianapolis, hope to serve the community itself. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Drew Dodlin reports on that grassroots event and the husband and wife team who made it happen.
Roe and Earl Townsend are slightly uncomfortable talking to me for this story. The husband and wife community organizers have an infectious passion for what they do, but Earl says they like to focus on the work.
We pretty much have all the recognition we can handle. You know, we don't. We're like, we're still the stand back people.
The reason they agreed to come out of their shell for a few minutes is because their latest project got really big really fast. It started with barbecue cookouts at their house in what some call the MLK neighborhood northwest of downtown Indianapolis. The parties were getting popular, so Roe enlisted help from cooks in the neighborhood, called it Open Bite Night, and posted about it on social media.
We were expecting it to be just like a bigger kind of cookout kind of a deal, and then it just turned into something else.
About 300 people showed up. They did it again a few months later on a blocked-off neighborhood street. It attracted 1,100 people, and Roe says even more couldn't come because there was nowhere left to park.
And it apparently was something that the neighborhood really wanted.
Now Roe and Earl partnered with Flanner House, a social service agency at the nearby Watkins Park, to give the event the space it needs. Open Bite Night is a lot of things put together. It's a six-hour outdoor party with 15 local cooks, 22 vendors, and 25 performers doing music and poetry. Many of those people live in the surrounding neighborhood. Rose says she wants to showcase local, unknown talents. And she also wants to turn those talents into jobs.
That's the other piece of this. It's like, no, don't just come here and cook. You can only come here and cook if you're willing to become an entrepreneur.
Earl talks with pride about locals who used previous Open Bite Nights as a launching pad. One now caters for Eli Lilly, another for Heron. Another has opened her own seafood restaurant.
And it just expands your sphere of influence. It's an amazing thing to watch. And it's so simple. It's so simple.
Roe and Earl are on the move for hours. They wear matching turquoise shirts with their names emblazoned on the back, shaking hands and hugging friends. One of those friends is Diamon Hargis, who lives in the neighborhood.
This is a microcosm of what exists in our neighborhood. If you go through our neighborhood, just even to this day, you would see a myriad of parties.
Hargis helps run the Learning Tree, a group focused on what some call asset-based community development. The approach is fueled by the idea that disenfranchised neighborhoods should be worked on from the inside, not just from outside institutions like United Way.
What we hope that is happening is that people that live in this neighborhood feel a sense of power to say we do not have to have institutions run over us.
Hargis says Open Bite Night is a great example of the asset-based philosophy in action, and he says the event's immediate and organic growth, this third installment attracted over 2,000 people, is evidence of its power.
I think it also brings people to be their truest self. So when people can relax and laugh and listen to entertainment, they hear things through a different lens, not on guard. You don't see many tables around. What you see are people walking side by side.
Usually what happens is we institutions say, hey, we have a really great idea. Come and join us in a really great idea. And this flips that script.
Michael Mather is also an advocate for asset-based development and a pastor at a neighborhood church. Mather says Roe and Earl's partnership with Flanner House, which provided space but took no control over the event, is a step in the right direction.
We talk about government officials, but we also talk about social service agencies as public servants. Well, we've acted like masters. And this is an example of an institution acting like a servant.
Mather says when institutions like his church fill out grant requests, the question is always, what's the biggest need among the group you're serving? The answer, he says he's learned, is to be needed.
Because that's what we all want. You want to be useful doing this, right? So, I mean, this is the idea. Everybody wants to be useful. You know, just seeing that, noticing that, investing in that makes things better, I think.
Rowan Earl started a nonprofit to help finance their community projects. They hope to make Open Bite Night a quarterly event. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Drew Dodlin.
A new federal law requires every state to calculate graduation rates in the same way. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Peter Ballin and Rosen reports, that means a change for Indiana schools.
One type of diploma known as a general diploma won't go away, but it'll no longer be counted in a school's graduation rate. That diploma has fewer academic requirements and testing than a standard diploma. Dana Renee, the chief executive ally at Autism Society of Indiana, says those general diplomas are important for students who get special education.
Just because they can't get through the assessments doesn't mean that they can't complete the coursework.
Renee and other advocates say they're concerned schools could lose reason to make sure students complete general diplomas if they're not counted in overall graduation rates. State officials say they're seeking clarification from the federal government as to when the new calculations will begin. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Peter Ballinon Rosen.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. It's summer in Indiana. We're in between the General Assembly session just completed and the long session at that, where they deal with the two-year budget and other issues, important ones, as you know, that have come up and have been sent on by the lawmakers to the governor for his consideration. And, as of course, we're not yet into the election season where we have another cycle of elections happening, but seem to be an awful lot of things involved in politics these days. And Andy Downs, who's executive director of the Mike Downs Center for Politics on the IU-Purdue Fort Wayne campus, is with us to talk about these things. Andy, thank you for being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, the Governor Eric Holcomb has kept busy in recent months. Of course, he just got back from a trade mission overseas, which has kept him occupied there, showing off Indiana to a number of European countries. And he's also spent some time on some big projects and made himself very visible on some other big issues that his predecessor, Mike Pence, seemed to shy away from. And there's one in particular that he has brought up, and in fact, even in recent days, that's something to talk about. Let's talk about the opioid crisis across Indiana. It's very heightened, of course, here in Northwest Indiana as well. But the governor stepped in and had some very personal things to say about this.
He did, and we should probably clarify that that Governor Holcomb is actually, some people say, undone several things that Governor Pence had done. For example, removing the previous criminal history box from the applications for state government employment, and of course, pardoning Keith Cooper. And a couple of other things. But the opioid thing is what's getting attention right now. People will remember that Mike Pence was actually opposed to the idea of needle exchange programs. He had to be convinced with an awful lot of information that that was the direction we needed to go, beginning down in Scott County and then in other counties. But with Eric Holcomb, we have somebody who has decided to not wait, but instead to become much more proactive. Some will argue not proactive enough, but much more proactive in trying to address these issues throughout the state. We have the 6 treatment centers that will be opening up sometime soon, depending on where you are. And I don't think that that's going to be the last that we hear about ways in which the opioid crisis will be addressed.
Do you think that in this particular case, and maybe some others as well, too, that we see the differences in the person between Mike Pence, who is a very religious conservative, and Eric Holcomb, who is definitely a conservative but a little different in nature?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, that helps to drive a couple of points home. Number one, that conservatives are not all the same. A lot of people like to lump conservatives and liberals all into the same camp, so to speak. But there's variety among conservatives. There's variety among liberals. And with Eric Holcomb, there were a lot of people wondering what he would be like or who he would be like. Would he be more like Mike Pence or would he be more like Mitch Daniels? Because he sort of straddled both worlds. And I think at this point, people are saying he's a little more Mitch Daniels-like than Eric Holcomb-like. And for some people, that makes them very happy. For other people, a little less so. But he's certainly not run away from social issues or sort of left traditional social issues behind, abortion, et cetera, but instead is being more proactive about some issues that are generally being agreed to be big problems in the state, like the opioid issue.
And I understand this in this last case here that Governor Holcomb has gotten rather emotional, which is not necessarily something that you might could see from Mike Pence.
No, Mike Pence, I think everybody understands Mike Pence is very, very put together. You'll occasionally see him get a little riled up when he's given a good red meat sort of speech. But he's not somebody you expected to see a lot of emotion from. Mitch Daniels didn't expect to see a lot of emotion from him either. Eric Holcomb is establishing himself as Eric Holcomb, and one of those things means being touched and moved by very difficult personal stories. And obviously, when it comes to things like drug addiction, it's easy to find stories that are just heart-wrenching. And those obviously have some effect on him.
Do you think that it's this attitude that he has had, certainly about the opioid crisis, that in turn kind of got lawmakers a bit more, I guess, maybe persuaded into helping fund more programs?
You know, I think that when it comes down to it, if people can speak from a personal standpoint, or if we can put a face to sort of the numbers of a problem, I think that's very helpful in terms of moving policy forward. And goodness knows, in counties across the state, we're seeing problems in terms of drug addiction, opioid drug problem being the big one right now. And there are a couple of legislators who took this on as their own issue because of either friends or family who were affected by it. And that's always going to kind of help move the issue forward. There are some folks who want to be, you know, very objective in their analysis of policy, et cetera. But when it comes right down to it, if you can put a face on a bunch of numbers, that makes it easier for people to understand and, in many respects, be compelled to move and want to do something about a problem.
One of the other people has been involved in politics for years and years, working with the General Assembly as well as with other issues in the state, has come back into the news lately here too. Luke Kendley, who is very instrumental in helping craft, in particular, this current two-year budget now in effect that was going through the legislature during the session earlier this year, and others in the past as well too, is very much involved in politics and with issues that we've talked about, road funding and bridge funding and the like. He's decided he was going to retire from his life as a politician. And now I understand there's some people that are already, well, this is not going to happen until into the fall. There are already people who are very interested in wanting to take his spot.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I think everybody probably remembers that when a sitting elected official leaves that office, whether it's because they move out of state or move on to another office or just retire from an office, or resign from an office, it's the precinct committee people in that jurisdiction who get to decide who the new office holder will be. And what that usually means is that the candidates who run in those caucuses have to campaign to just a handful of people instead of having to campaign to the, you know, 60,000 or so people who happen to live in a state senate district. Now it's just going to be campaigning to the 100 or so precinct committee people. That's a whole lot more manageable. Granted, the time frame's a lot more compressed. But caucuses bring candidates out of the woodwork. It's a smaller group to campaign to, and there's really no danger in throwing your hat in the ring. In other words, if you're a member of the Indiana House of Representatives and you try to run in a primary for a state Senate seat, you're pretty much giving up your House seat. But in this case, you can throw your hat in the ring, and if you don't win the caucus, mm-hmm. no harm, no foul. You just go back to the office you held.
And we know even in one particular case that just recently you got word that a member of the Noblesville City Council in the county in which Luke Kendley resides and is presiding is interested in taking his spot when it's time for this caucus to come about.
Yeah, and I think we can expect to see several other people, many of them probably elected officials, stepping up wanting to do that. It makes sense that someone from Noblesville would want to do that. That's a large part of the district that, in terms of the folks who live in it, a large number of them live in Noblesville. It's a place that I think a lot of people look to for leadership within that district. It's not the only place, obviously, but for a lot of folks, they sort of think of that as, if not the seat, so to speak, of the district, certainly a place of great importance. But that doesn't mean that's the only person. Obviously, there are other municipalities in that area, or for that matter, even county officials, or for that matter, state representatives who might decide this is a seat that's of interest to them.
We're talking with Andy Downs, who is the executive director of the Mike Downs Center for Politics at IU Purdue Fort Wayne. And Andy, there's, person in particular who's in a seat in Congress that's going to have some opposition, apparently. And there's also another seat that is being debated for some people to become candidates as well on the southern part of the state. And I guess the next congressional race isn't going to happen until next year. Interesting, we got some people that already said that they want to be running for office.
And normally we get a little time off, so to speak. And when you look at the nature of some of the congressional districts in Indiana, it's kind of surprising that you would have Democrats stepping up and wanting to take on an incumbent Republican in some of these very strong Republican districts. For example, the 3rd District where I'm sitting, it's a very Republican district. But we now have a number of people who have filed, including a couple of gadflies, and one person who I think people will identify as a legitimate candidate. She has a business background. She has some presence in the community already. And so I think there are people who are going to say she's a legitimate candidate, giving the Democrats at least some shot at that seat. But perhaps more impressively, down in the 9th District, which is the southeastern portion of the state, there are 3 Democrats looking to take on Trey Hollingsworth down there. And the 3 Democrats, on paper at least, look kind of like legitimate candidates. Now, none of them has run for office himself, so they haven't had to go out there and raise the money and be the target of all the slings and arrows the way that a candidate has. But on paper, you know, they look pretty good. And I'm sure the Democrats are very excited about that throughout the state and look for more people to step up and do that. This is going to be, I think, 2018, an interesting year. And remember, it's only July of 2017.
Are we finding that since we have all these people that are interested in running for public office, and in particular for a congressional seat, that they realize not only do they have to do a lot of work in raising funds to be able to hold a campaign aloft so long if they decide to start early, but also, too, that they just know it's going to take a lot of their own personal time out to, they might as well get started now and start approaching the potential voters?
Well, you really do. You know, this is we've sort of left the time period where someone can blitz a campaign and have huge impact, especially somebody who's going to have a difficulty raising money. And you think about the Democrats in the two districts that I just mentioned. You know, those are districts that Democrats nationwide wouldn't really be targeting, saying, "Oh, yes, we're going to win that one." The ninth, a little more so than the third district, and that means that people are going to have to spend an awful lot of time raising money. They're going to have to raise over $1 million. And keep in mind that individual donations per election are $2,700. That's an awful lot of people, even if you can get them to max out, who have to max out to get up to $1 million. And it's one part raising money, spending an awful lot of time on the phone. And by the way, the incumbents, Jim Banks and Trey Hollingsworth, they'll be spending a lot of time on the phone raising money as well. But it also means getting out in the district and going to every lunch and dinner and breakfast they can get to, and walking neighborhoods and meeting with community leaders. It just is it's truly a time-intensive effort that people are committing to when they decide to run for office. And you're right, they can't do it just sort of quickly from, say, May of 2018 to November of 2018. The districts are, you know, they have enough people in them, 600,000+ people in them. They got to go out and talk to an awful lot of people. They might as well spread that out over a little more time. It also gives them time to build up name recognition a little more throughout the entire district and take a little more time developing the campaign and their stance on issues so that they're really well prepared by the time we get to the hot and heavy stuff of the summer of 2018.
And certainly when you're talking about the 9th Congressional District, which is down in southeast Indiana, you have more counties, and they're mostly rural counties. There are only just a few larger communities in that whole area there. And so you've got to make a lot of campaign stops in a lot of small communities all across that part of the state to get to the voters and tell them your views and get their support. So it's a little different than if you're based in Fort Wayne, like you are, and having that district there. It's a little more compact, and there are a number of counties up there, of course, to do some campaigning in, but not quite as spread out as down south, I would sure.
Yeah, there's no doubt. You know, you think about Monroe County, where Bloomington is, and then running all the way over to the eastern border. That, you know, that's not something that you do in 20 minutes. And there are a lot of small towns, like you said, between the borders of that district that you have to stop in and say hello to people.
We're talking with Andy Downs, who is the executive director of the Mike Downs Center for Politics at IU Purdue Fort Wayne. Andy, thank you for spending time with us to talk about some Hoosier politics during the summer months, and we'll be back with you soon, I hope.
It's always a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Well, we seem to talk about a lot of major league sports, baseball, basketball, hockey, football, of course. What is going to be the next major sport? It turns out to be something that you maybe had not thought about, esports. To find out more about it and look into further discussion that's been recently published in The Conversation, we have Galen Clavio, who is a professor of radio and television sports journalism. And he's also the director of the National Sports Journalism Center, which is based at Indiana University's Bloomington campus. And thank you very much, Galen, for being with us today to talk about this.
Thanks for having me on.
What got the idea of creating esports? Obviously, I guess maybe it's kind of a further extension of the usual games that we play on our home devices, on our handheld devices alike.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a combination of two things. It's the participatory aspect of playing what we would call video games in a competitive environment online, primarily via the internet. But it's also the act of watching other people playing those games. And, you know, that's really kind of what helped it transition into a bona fide sport. It's not just people playing it. It's people wanting to watch other people playing it.
That's kind of an extension of the actual sport itself, isn't it, for the most part?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, it's ultimately a newer thing, but it's not something that is completely foreign to anybody who grew up around video games. You know that, yeah, a lot of times you're playing, but more often than not, you know, you're in, you know, a rec room or somebody's house, and you're watching them playing as well, and you're trading, you know, back and forth and taking turns.
Give us an idea, if you will, some of the statistics, the information that's out there people can look up as well, too, on how popular esports have become and where the trends seem to be going.
When we talk about esports, first of all, I think it's important to make clear that we're talking about a whole group of games. So we're talking about things like League of Legends, which is an online battle arena where teams of four or five players are going up against each other. That particular game, you're talking about, awards for, prize money going into the tens of millions of dollars at events that they have, two or three events throughout the course of the year just in the United States. 100 million players across, the U.S. and Asia and Europe. FIFA, that game by EA, the soccer game, they have a world tournament that culminates in 32 players playing for, kind of like the world title. But at the beginning, they have 2.3 million people taking part in that tournament from the start. So, yeah, it gives you a little bit of an idea of just, the huge numbers of people that are already taking part in these things.
Now, in doing your work, of course, not only for your classes where you bring this up and your discussions from the National Sports Journalism Center, but it's a conversation that's also in the conversation online. You do some looking, I'm sure, into why people tend to take advantage of this. Is it a lot easier for people to be involved with this type of event as opposed to actually getting involved in the sport itself or even some sport itself?
I think to some degree, yes, in as much as there's an entertainment aspect that grows out of people's relationship with video games that, it took the internet and it took, companies like Valve, who has a service called Steam where people can kind of get together and play things. It took those sorts of things establishing to kind of bring players together. If you want to play basketball, you can find a group of guys or girls and go out and play pickup at the local court. It was harder to do that with video games until we entered this particular era. And I think what we find as we talk to people is, yes, there's a big element of people who play the game recreationally and then want to watch better players playing the game. And it's a similar process to what you see with a lot of sports. People that you're going to be probably more interested in watching baseball if you're playing like beer league softball. You want to be able to watch people who are at the top of their profession playing that same thing that you're doing in your spare time. I don't think it's any different with esports.
Now, I know that, and you mentioned this too in the article that's online about the importance to university-based teams. So obviously we have university students very much interested in sports. Maybe they're not interested enough or qualified enough for that matter to actually be able to participate on the teams at their particular college or university, but they're certainly getting involved in all of these. And you mentioned the League of Legends as one such organization.
Right. I think it's important to keep in mind. I mean, there are particular skill sets. When we say sports, we don't necessarily mean athletics, but we do mean competition. And, it's interesting because League of Legends or Overwatch, which is another game that's become very popular lately, they do require, a very particular set of skills, a lot of fast twitch muscle response, a lot of hand-eye coordination. And, it seems relatively simple until you start trying to play the game, and it's very difficult. I think universities are looking at the popularity of these games and saying, our idea behind having sports is really to extend our brand. There's a reason why people have heard of a lot of the Big Ten schools across the world, and yes, academics certainly play a large part, but you get your foot in the door to some degree by having success on the athletic field. People know Michigan or Ohio State as much for their football teams, if not more so, than they do for their academics. And I think that what we're seeing with esports is just a further extension of that, trying to reach new demographics and new groups of people who, may not watch traditional sports, may not be that interested in them, but are interested in esports and the culture that surrounds it.
So you see this as a kind of a natural evolution of the overall sports media landscape that we've been, of course, witness to for many decades.
I do. What really got me interested in this to begin with was I remember one night about 3-4 years ago, I was flipping around on the cable channels and came across ESPN2. It was like 11 o'clock at night. And they were televising it was called Heroes of the Dorm. And it's one of these online battle arena games. And they had broadcasters, and they had like really high production values, and they had this arena. It was Key Arena in Seattle, where the Seattle Supersonics used to play, and the place was sold out. There were 15,000 people in this arena watching these two teams of esports players playing this game. And I looked at this, and I immediately like got a copy, brought it into my sports broadcasting class, and I was like, look, we need to learn how to broadcast this, because this is going to be a major thing moving forward, and we're seeing that now. I mean, Turner and ESPN and Fox.
We're talking esports with IU Bloomington campus broadcasting and sports journalist and professor Galen Clavio. And now on this Monday, it's another edition of Eye on the Arts with John Kane.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Kirk Muspratt, music director and conductor of the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra. And Kirk, you're here today to talk about the upcoming Summer Music Festival.
I am, and I'm very excited about it, John. Thanks for having me.
Tell us about it. How many concerts?
We have five, and I'll tell you about the Saturdays first because they're just easy to remember. So we start in Cedar Lake on the 22nd. Mm-hmm. The next Saturday, we play in Crown Point on July the 29th. Mm-hmm. The next Saturday, we play in August 5th, we play in Griffith. And the last Saturday, we play in Schererville at Reeder Park. Mm-hmm. We also play one concert on a Friday night, which is in Wolf Lake, and that's on the 11th of August.
Okay. And are you, I know last year we did the Indiana Bicentennial as our theme, and we have no Bicentennial to celebrate this year. So is there any kind of particular link between the music that you're selecting?
Some of it is to sell next season a little bit. Like we're doing some Tchaikovsky because we're doing a big Tchaikovsky concert. Mm-hmm. We're doing some Hispanic music because next year our education program is centered around Latin culture and Hispanic music. Mm-hmm. We always do something for the kids, so we're going to do Harry Potter. But one of the things we're also doing is we're doing some music from South Pacific to sort of encourage people to come to our Rodgers and Hammerstein, Kern-type concert Showboat at mm-hmm. the end of the season, mm-hmm. just to advertise and let people know what we're doing next season and to see kind of what we're doing. Oh, also, I should say that it's JFK's 100th birthday, mm-hmm. so we're going to play JFK.
Recently celebrated.
And it's also Bernstein's 100th birthday, so we're going to play Candide of Bernstein.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
That's a great tune.
It is. It
I
is.
Just love that.
It is. So fun.
Yeah.
So it witty.
It is. People really enjoy it.
And we're going to actually ask Ben, our associate conductor, to conduct it this year.
Oh, cool.
To give him some experience. He's a very gifted young guy.
He's always there anyway.
I know.
That's good.
He sure is.
Put a baton in his hand. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's good. Well, that'll be fun for him, too. Now, I know that since I also work for the symphony, I'm on the inside track. So I know that we, in addition to the regular South Shore Summer Music Festival 5 concerts, we have two additional concerts that are sponsored separately, mm-hmm. One by the Porter County Community Foundation, and that is in Valpo on, August 2nd, I think?
It's August the 2nd, yes. And it's also BMO.
Uh-huh, right.
BMO is our other sponsor.
And then the other concert, the other standalone concert, is the one at the Indiana Dunes?
On the 4th.
4th of August.
Yeah, and we just started doing that last year. It was a wonderful success and a beautiful setting to play. We're grateful for the Indiana Dunes sponsorship and mm-hmm. them involving us in that culture, too.
The Valpo one is performed downtown in Central Park Plaza.
Packed to the joint.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And the Indiana Dunes one is at West Beach.
Mm. I don't know because the policemen just take me there with their hats on, and I'm like, okay, it's a forest ranger, and I'm Yogi the Bear. I just go.
I think it's at West Beach, is off of County Line Road.
Is that close to Ogden Dunes?
It's between Miller and Ogden Dunes.
Yeah, then that's where it is.
Okay,
yeah.
Good.
Yeah, sorry. They just come and get me and go there, Kirk, you know.
That's funny. All right. Well, and we do have great settings for these concerts. We have the lawn at the Franciscan Homes in Crown Point, uh-huh. which is adjacent to the hospital, of course. We have the park. What is the park called in Cedar Lake where we perform?
Oh, I don't know.
It's where they
have, it's right on the lake. I mean, my gosh.
It's
on the lake,
and it's where they have the historic hotel.
Yeah.
And the lighthouse museum. Restaurant.
Yeah, right? And the lighthouse is there, yeah.
That's dumb of us not to know the name of it. And in Griffith, it's Central Park.
Central Park. And they're going to turn the concert around this year, John. They're going to face the other way in Central Park because they can accommodate more people. There's so many people coming to the concert now.
And Sheriff Hill is Reeder Park.
Reeder, yeah.
And Hammond, of course, is the Wolf Lake Pavilion. That pavilion is gorgeous.
It's gorgeous. It's a fantastic thing that they built there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what is some of the other music? We just have a few more.
Well, you know, I'm going to do some James Bond just for you, John.
Oh, thank you.
You know, okay.
Yes. And shaken, not stirred.
Yeah, exactly. we'll do some, I'm going to do some Spider-Man, which is very, you know, very famous. Oh, and we're going to do some Star Wars. We're going to do Throne Room and the end title from Star Wars. So hopefully there's a mix. We go all the way from Copeland to Hoedown to James Bond and Spider-Man and John Williams.
So you have kind of free reign this year to select stuff
That,
as you please, since we're not constrained by grant funding and themes. We really like the grant funding, though.
We do. We do. And it's our 76th anniversary coming up, but I just couldn't find enough 76
trombones.
Things. Yeah, exactly.
So that's going to get old, but we're gonna milk that.
We are.
Okay. Thank you, Kirk, for being
John.
To tell us about the South Shore Summer Music Festival starting July 22nd in Cedar Lake. And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
Thank you, John. And if you want to hear this conversation again and the others in the Eye on the Arts series, you can go to our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, and take a listen there, too. And you can join us back here on Regionally Speaking next Monday for another Eye on the Arts conversation. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. Tomorrow on the program, a conversation with the Portage Police Chief Troy Williams as he continues our ongoing conversation about crime spillover from Illinois into Indiana. We hope you'll join us for that.